Welcome to Around the Reel with your hosts, Aaron Carlson, Charles Lawson, and Samantha Hanna. Ah, shit. Here we go again.
Don't you? I am telling you how it is, my dear friend.
Well, I appreciate that, Charles.
What it is, what it was, and what it always shall be. Yeah, coming to you live from the 70s. We're going to go back and listen to the Commodores. Let's go and dive in, shall we?
They didn't really say that on like the R&B channels. They didn't say dive.
Hello,
they didn't say,
let me get my sound on.
You sound good to us.
Yeah, you sound good.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
We sure can.
Yep. Yes, can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
There.
Yep.
Okay, good now.
Do you see all of us on the screen right now?
Yes, I do.
Perfect.
Perfect.
All right, we're awesome, all set up then.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're babbling for a second, so excuse us while we dive back into this. You are correct. There is nothing more false than the white person representation of what 70s R&B music stations actually sound like back in the day. Because you just sit here and you listen to all those things where everyone's like, oh my God, everybody had the most bass voice and it was always
cool.
It's like... But the R&B channels were just like, hey, man, we're going to play some stuff. Let's go.
No, they never sucked like that. They were smooth, bro. See, you never listened, Chuck. You were too busy on like
country stations.
And stuff. I was always listening. I didn't listen to any country until the 90s.
Well, then you would have
I grew up listening to R&B surf songs because my dad, and then whatever was new because my mom was always trying to stay hip with what was going on.
Right. But you
gotta remember, I was 10 years old before I realized the Beatles or the Beach Boys weren't touring anymore.
My brother's dad used to be a DJ down at Bates College here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And he would be on, I think his block was from like midnight until 3 or 4 in the morning or something, until the morning shift came on. Yeah. Yeah. You should have heard him at night. He was smooth motherfucker. He was badass. It was great. It was great.
Hi, Andy.
Hello. How you guys doing?
Good.
Hi, Andy.
How you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you too.
Yeah,
both of you guys. It's awesome. Thanks for coming.
Yes. We're excited to talk about this. Super excited.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, don't mind us like we told Mark. We start our show by talking about
shit.
We kind
of banter a little.
Yeah, just whatever.
Yeah, we talk as we start the show. We're talking as, like 10 minutes before the show starts, and we hit record and then bring everybody in while we continue our normal banter.
That's what we do.
We're just talking about the smoothness of 70s R&B DJs.
Mm-hmm. And how Chuck is not that person.
I am the farthest thing from a 70s black man. I will admit it right now, everybody. I'm sorry. I'm capable of many things, but being an R&B black man from the 70s
ain't gonna happen for you, Charles.
Oh goodness.
All right. Well,
of course, Aaron can't pull it off either. So
no,
we're good.
No, and I never admit a try. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. No, not at all.
And but, I don't even know what you guys are talking about. I mean, I do, but I don't.
You know, it's just, it's nothing.
It it's nothing.
R&B is a style of music, and they used to play it on this thing called the radio that people used to tune into before they started using streaming services for everything.
Yeah, which is why I wanted to do a radio talk show kind of thing, but we just do it in podcast form. I get it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right.
And we are performing in front of a live canned audience.
We sure are.
A canned audience, yeah.
All right. Let's get to our guests. So. Here we are.
Yes.
And welcome to Around the Reel, everybody.
Welcome to Around the Reel.
Welcome to Around the Reel.
So Sam had been setting up a ton of interviews lately, and she got you guys, and I'm going to let her start doing her thing and tell us what's going on, because this is fun.
What? Okay, putting Sam on the spot is fun?
Yeah, it's fun.
Putting me on the spot is fun?
It's fun.
Well, they did a movie, a short, it's called American Grail, the quest for the ivory-billed woodpecker. Did I get that right? It's a long name. It's a long name, so you'll have to.
It doesn't just roll off the tongue.
It's a title.
Well, it does. Well, if you say it a few times, but I should have said it. I should have started off saying that a bunch of times before we started. No, but we watched it. We all watched it, and it was really good and very fun, and unbelievably took the quest itself took you 17 years. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I've been involved with it for 17 years. I've had possible sightings going back. My first possible sighting was in 2008. Okay. But it took 17 years to get the paper published, to get the amount of evidence that we collected, to get it into peer reviewed format. I had my only short sighting that's described in the film in 2021, and that was, you know, that was kind of a realization, and that was 14 years after 14 years. I started.
Wow. And spoiler alert, everybody, that was not a duck.
It was not a duck.
It was not a duck, yeah. No, but very cool, very cool, I think. Just to go on a journey like that. And especially, and you're from New York?
Yeah.
New York, so yeah. To go on that journey must have been just crazy.
Yeah, how was that like?
Well, I had never really been to the Deep South before. I'd been to the Carolinas, I'd been to Florida, but I'd never been to Louisiana or really anywhere in the Deep South. So that was kind of quite an adventure. And my partner in the search for many years, he died in 2017. His name was Frank Wiley, and he was a real kind of stone cold Louisiana redneck and proud of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Jewish guy from New York, you know, and we hit it off and had a collaboration that lasted until its death. So,
so you had a tour guide then?
Well, I wouldn't call him my tour guide. I call him my entree into Louisiana culture, and he did give me a lot of knowledge about the forest down there, which I did not have going in.
Right,
I've since supplemented that with a lot of additional research and other work on my own. But Frank was really a mentor in that way. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so we make films too. So we're filmmakers. We happen to do a podcast as well. Sam's our documentarian here. She's got her second doc coming out here soon called A Will and a Way. We know the work it takes to kind of make these things. You know, the grind that it takes, you know, following a story. Being almost like that newscaster guy when you're out there trying to catch that story and make it right.
Yeah.
So, Andy, well, how did you get involved in this story? How did you hear about it? And how did you come to fruition? How did this whole thing come to fruition? What happened?
Yeah, so I think my friend and collaborator, Jolene Pender, she was the producer on this. And she reached out to me and basically was going to attach a director to the project. I'm an Iranian-American filmmaker that grew up in the Ozarks. I have been splitting time between Arkansas and New Orleans, for the past few years. And it was a film that was pretty much right up my alley. I mean, a lot of my films that I've had to date deal with humans and our relationship with the natural world, and the American South, and just like as someone that grew up here, you know, someone that has that, I spent a lot of time in the woods. And it is my community. It's where I'm from. And so, it seemed like a really good fit. There's also certain elements of the story that, I was drawn to and wanted to, explore as a creative and a filmmaker. And the team that I had, you know, Jolene Pender, the producer, and Jane Geisler, the editor, Louis Michaud, composer, Adam Sekuler, the sound designer, they were just a dream team to work with, and I'm really proud of what we made.
That's awesome, buddy. Yeah. Okay, all right.
And you also, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but you also have, that's not your only film that you had in The Big Sky, correct? You have another, at least one more?
Yeah. It was a busy year last year. I directed four shorts.
Oh, wow, okay.
One premiere at Hot Springs Doc Fest in New Orleans. I had one premiere at Sundance and two premiere at Big Sky.
Very nice,
yeah.
Buddy.
Yeah, very cool.
Shit, Andy putting in work, bro.
Yeah.
That's right.
That is a lot of work. So I also did a nature documentary. My last one was a nature documentary about my area. So yeah. I did one on the giant Pacific octopus, which is native to here in the Pacific Northwest. So.
Yeah.
So, I definitely love that. And I love the exploration of animals and the different areas and stuff like that. And especially the ones that aren't as easy to find anymore because of us, basically.
Right.
And so that's always pretty cool. And to find that it's still, you know, that you found proof that still still alive and kicking, that's pretty cool, I think. Which is, that's got a, which I hate to be a spoiler alert there, but obviously you found it.
Proof is complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I, one of the big issues is what constitutes proof around this species in particular. And the scientific standard that the government has applied to it is compelling evidence. Mm-hmm. And in 2005, they believed that compelling evidence was found in Arkansas. They since made a move to declare it extinct in spite of that. And that was part of the reason that we felt it very important to get this paper out when we did get it out. I think what we present in a sane world should be considered proof. But the standard for this species is off the charts high.
Oh, wow.
And therefore, we did not convince everybody. We definitely moved the dial, I think moved it quite a bit, but there we've definitely received criticism and doubts from some in the community.
Yeah, well, I was gonna talk about that and ask you about that, actually, that you talked just briefly in your film about it, but so is there a community of people that are actually on this, you know, on the same quest to find this proof that you didn't necessarily get along with them all, or or?
Well,
was
I mean,
without
going into that, there are a good many people out there searching. Some
but
of them
very
really
serious is my point. They're very serious about it.
Yeah. There's one guy in particular named Bobby Harrison who was also very much involved with the Arkansas thing in 2005. He presented a video at the same time that we were presenting our evidence to Fish and Wildlife. And I find his video and the arguments that he makes for it compelling. I don't think he got quite as much traction as we did. He didn't publish a peer-reviewed paper. Mm. But he's been incredibly dedicated. And there are others with similar levels of dedication out there. But then there's the whole ornithological and scientific community, which is the audience that we were mainly trying to convince with the paper.
Correct. Yeah.
And then birders are a whole other group. Moving parts to it.
Well, that's pretty cool. Well, for those of us that didn't really know anything about that, that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, it seemed like a big deal. And I don't even understand what that entails. Like that paper you're talking about, that ending of the film, you know, when we find out something, you know, can you go into any detail about what the importance of that is for us so we can get a better grasp of how your reaction was?
To the publication, you mean?
Correct.
The publication, yeah.
Well, because the climate around the ivory bill is so charged and there's so much controversy, I thought that getting a paper published would be monumentally difficult, if not impossible. I don't want to go into all the details, but we had a paper that should have been accepted that was rejected because of fear of the publication. I was second author on this paper, I was lead author on another paper that was purely historical in nature. And when it went out for peer review, one of the peer reviewers who had an axe to grind wrote privately to the editor and said, you should not publish this. And here are the reasons. The reasons were all kind of self-serving and had nothing to do with the merits of the paper. But this individual has clout, and as a result, that paper did not get published in that journal. We went somewhere else and did get it published. But with this species, there's a lot of intensity on all sides.
Why is that? I'm struggling with that piece of it. Like, why does anybody care whether or not a woodpecker is extinct or not? Like, what am I missing?
You
I'm
know,
gonna, I'm gonna all that t-shirt money because, you know, it's not around anymore.
I don't understand.
How does that work?
I don't completely get it myself.
Okay.
I'm on for over 100 years.
Yeah.
So I think because it has incredible symbolic importance, it's very dramatic in appearance. Beginning in the 19th century, it was sort of identified with the South and with the frontier. And there was this narrative beginning really even in the 18th century that this bird vanished with the coming of the white man and with clearing of fields and the axe and the plow. And it got conflated in a lot of the narratives, actually with Native Americans themselves, as sort of a symbol of the frontier that had to disappear with the march of civilization. And so I think that's all kind of entwined in this.
I get it. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Now. They don't want to change the textbooks.
I get it.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. I got it. I got it.
Holy crap. There's so many things on the world, in the world that's going on that we have zero clue about. And that's why I love what you're doing, Sam, Andy, what you do. Like, these topics we would never know about if it wasn't for movies like this. You know what I mean? And that's what's cool. When you guys dive into a project like this or a story about someone or something, it's not only educational, it's entertaining, but it's like, holy shit, people are doing this? Like, what the fuck? I mean, that's what's crazy about it. Andy, what got you started in documentaries? Like, how did you get rolling in wanting to follow these kind of stories?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would totally agree with you. I mean, that's one of my things that I love about documentaries. It gives me an excuse to be curious and, like, just meet people I would never meet otherwise, go places I would never go otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it's like my job. If I won the lottery, I would still be doing this tomorrow. What got me into doc is actually interesting. I did work in academia before all of this. I had published peer-reviewed papers, and I didn't feel like peer-reviewed papers made a difference in the world like documentary could. There was a particular instance for me. So my graduate degree is in sustainable agriculture and food systems. I read an article about a dairy farmer in upstate New York that killed all of his cows and then killed himself under the weight of the dairy industry. And for me, it was kind of like, well, like, no peer-reviewed article that explains you know, how messed up our dairy system is in the United States is going to have nearly the impact of this one human story. Mm-hmm. And so I actually did not end up making that film because I was in my first semester of grad school and I loved what I did and everything was covered. But I tried to get every student in the MFA program to make this film with me. And one girl was very interested. Her and her partner decided to pursue pregnancy. And so she stepped back and the project never got made, but it never left me. It's like a tattoo. Like it, like after 3 years, I still wanted to do this. Like it, like I'd finished my degree. I got a job in academia and I was still like, felt the pull to make films and documentary. That was kind of like, I usually use that. That story was like kind of the catalyst for me. And I grew up watching film. I mean, I watch cinema all the time. I mean, when I was in high school, it was my goal to watch all the AFI top 100 films of the 20th century and so on and so forth. So, yeah, okay. I've always felt like the best media.
Very cool. Well, wow.
It gets in us, guys.
It does.
It gets in you.
In one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't much of a film person, but I did like documentaries. And so when I met Aaron, he did all these films. That was kind of my... That was my way into the whole world because I wasn't as comfortable acting or with the other stuff as much as I was the documentary stuff. And that's been great. That's been fun because I'm like, I'm just one of those people that believes you never stop learning. When you die, I'll stop learning when I die. That's basically
it. And it only took you 15 years to dive into documentaries. Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
No, but that's it. I mean, I think that a lot of the world's problems are due to lack of education. And so that's why I think documentaries are so important. And if you make them interesting enough and people will watch them, then you're educating people. You're going to teach people about things they don't know about, like Aaron said, things that we don't normally know about or we wouldn't go out and seek the information of. That's what we do as documentarians is we seek that information for people so that they have something interesting to watch that we can tell the story.
Exactly.
And teach people about things. And that's why it's always important. And I'm such a a knowledge seeker and truth seeker too when it comes to now that I've learned to be.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to, you know, you never want to put false information out there or anything. So I'm a fact checker big time. I like to, you know, make sure that I have all my information correct before I put it out there. But one thing that I found interesting about that is the different opinions. Like sometimes it's not about facts. It's about this person's opinion and that person's opinion. And so that's also important, is to try to get everyone's opinion in there and all sides of the story if you can. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, and it's definitely a crazy thing to make a documentary, isn't it?
Well, what I like, yeah, what I like, what like they're doing, like when you see that there's passion on both sides of this, like Mark was talking about, where, you know, one side is kind of hot about this topic and another part people are too for another reason. Mm-hmm. You're like, wow, that's crazy, because I would have never guessed that this woodpecker would be such a big deal. However, there are things in our culture that I see all the time that defines this over and over and over. It doesn't matter what subject it is. Everybody's got something to say about something, mm-hmm. right? So in our new documentary, we were just talking about it last night. There's a piece in there that we've got a few notes on that people have said, hey, it's not released yet, guys, but there's a part where someone says something about what they believe in. And we've had notes saying, is that necessary, or should maybe you guys think about taking that piece out? But here's the thing. I think documentaries are important to kind of explain a story in a way where you can surprise an audience still with things, right? So if you find out and you're watching a documentary from the beginning and you're half hour in and you're really into it, and you really like somebody a lot and you're following their story, and then all of a sudden they say something that goes against what you believe in. Did we trick you to like somebody that you wouldn't have given a chance to because of how they believe in something? Or do we cut that out so that you have this false narrative in your head that they're not that way? Like, what do you do? What do you do as a director or a filmmaker? What do you do? That's what's interesting to me about them. And that's why I always put that shit in there. Just in case. Well, just in case it can stay and Sam doesn't say, cut that out. I want to keep it in there.
I think we should say what it is. It's political.
Yes.
It's someone's political view. And and we've had a couple of comments of people who have watched it and came back with, you know, maybe you shouldn't put that in there. And because they don't want us to lose people because of that. And because the political thing has been so hardcore, mm-hmm. I guess, you know, that is very valid thing that could happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people are so hardcore one way or the other that they might quit. But those aren't the people I'm trying, I guess, to watch it then. I don't know. You got to feel strongly about.
Or how many of those people are you going to slap in the face with reality that even though they're not politically the same as that person, they've been watching them for a good half hour before they knew that and liked them.
But the funny thing is Aaron yes. and I are not that way politically.
No.
It is a different political view than we have.
Yes.
And yeah. I have.
And it's I went out there. Yeah, I went out there just like Mark was from New York, had to go to the South, didn't understand any of that shit. He went out in the woods and the swamp battling. I went to the country, bro. I'm a city kid.
He milked the cow.
I'm half black. I went out there and milked the fucking cow with a bunch of people that I was like, what the fuck am I doing? And why am I having so much fun? I absolutely love it. So if I can do it, why can't they?
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, guys. Tangents, but yeah, when we start to talk about filmmaking and stories, we can do this sometimes. Go ahead, Andy.
I think it's great. I totally agree with you. I mean, in terms of like showing complexity in humans, because everything is, I mean, the other film that I had that played at Big Sky was Wild Hogs and Saffron, and that's me and my childhood friend Bubba. We go on a wild hog hunt together, and I'm half Iranian, and he has this idea of like what it means to be Iranian, and people also have their, I know plenty of people from the coast that have their idea of who a guy like Bubba is. And he says some pretty crazy shit throughout mm-hmm. the course of the film. But then he like the humanity that he shows like throughout that, like as it's revealed. And he was at Big Sky with me as well. And just cool. like, he's so vulnerable and real that it's and he was a total hit. Like everybody was like finding him at the parties and afterwards and so on and so forth, because I think people have this idea, you know, and Bubba's very real about what his initial impressions of being from the Middle East are and so on and so forth. But then he like shows this like crazy nuance and complexity that like make him compelling as a human being, because you can't put him into a box, and he's about as real as it gets. And I love that about film, and I think it, you know, I fully applaud, you know, pursuing that.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I think it's vital. I really do. Good for you, man. That's dope. Yeah. That's dope.
Yeah.
Whew.
Well, I think that's all about education, and I think that people sometimes get, you know, when they're not around things, and this could go for anything, animals, people, you know, no matter what, if they're not around things enough, they don't have enough experience about it, they don't really know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they place judgment on that situation without really knowing, you know, who someone really is or what the situation really is. And so I think that's the magic of documentaries as well, is that we can teach people that. We can maybe possibly make someone love this other side of something because they hadn't thought of it that way or whatever the case is. But that's what I tried to do in my first documentary as well. So now, hands down to you, Andy, for being able to portray that, you know,
it's and dope.
It's dope. It is. It's very cool. That's the fun of documentaries. There's a little trickery in there, but it's fun.
Yeah, tell the story you want to tell. God damn it. But you got all these facts, but why leave something out? You know what I mean? It's important. And just find the tactical way in the editing room where to put that. You know? How do you put this piece together? That's what you do. And if you do it right, you ain't gonna lose nobody. They're gonna be shocked when they find something out that they didn't realize, and then be like, oh my God. They're gonna hang in there just fine after that. And then they might even question themselves, like, wow, like I did, like, wow, these people don't politically think like I think, but I'm having a blast with them over here filming this thing. So, wow, I guess we are just humans, aren't we? How about that?
Go figure.
Totally. And, you know, one of my mentors said to me years ago, always cater to the smartest of your audience in film and cinema, and it will be a better film. And I think, like, in The Grail, like, what, you know, I set out to do was just show, like, the complexity of, like, I think the ivory-billed woodpecker in and of itself is, I would say, interesting to a very small group of people, mm-hmm. but it's like the people that are looking for the ivory-billed or what, from a film and cinema perspective, are what's going to make people interested in the story of this bird. And so just like showing the complexities of, like, I'm very interested in like the broader ivory bill searcher community, because it's like a complex tapestry of humanity. That's like, everybody's looking for the bird and from like, but it's such a, like, as you mentioned earlier, Aaron, it's like such a niche, search that it's fascinating from a filmmaker's perspective to illustrate, you know, the complexities that go into this. They work very hard, but they also have very different views and different reasons for looking for the bird. And that is, I find that incredibly fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, Mark, how did you get on to the bird thing? Because I know you've got a history of being an educator, and something we should talk about before the show ends, because I remember that stuff.
I haven't seen you in 30 years, by the way.
Yeah, I remember that stuff in the 90s, right? It's great. But please, Mark, how did you get involved with the woodpecker? I didn't know if I missed that in the doc or not. Like, what got you passionate about it?
I was really, really avidly into birds as a kid, like ages 9 to 13, 14.
Okay.
And I really wanted to be a biologist at that time, ornithologist at that time. My math skills were not anywhere good enough to keep me going. I got a D in chemistry, and that was kind of the end for me. But so I had this passion for birds as a kid, and it's stayed with me. I haven't birded throughout my life, but from time to time over the years, I've gone in and out of birding in varying degrees of seriousness. The ivory bill was at the center of that, because in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a kind of an upsurge in the controversy, with some evidence presented that was, I think, falsely challenged as being faked, but from Texas and Louisiana at that time. And I remember reading about it, and the bird captivated me then. I think by the time like the late 80s rolled around, I really had figured it was gone. Then in 99, there was a very, I thought, very convincing report from Louisiana that really kind of sparked my interest 2005, Cornell reported and published a paper saying the bird persists in Arkansas. And there was a huge controversy around that. And I sort of unwittingly jumped into the online controversy.
Got it.
And 2 years later, I'm like, well, I might as well get out in the field myself.
Like, fuck it, I'm gonna go find this bird.
I can bring something unique to this. I may not be the most skilled woodsman in the world, but I can think about this problem from angles that people haven't really thought about it from before.
Wow, okay. Yeah, definitely.
That's kind of how it went.
All right.
Here I am, you know, what, 18 years later, almost 20
years.
That's
very cool.
Well, that is awesome. You mentioned in, I think, the short something about the Bigfoot thing, too. I won't forget. Anytime somebody mentions something about Bigfoot, it scares the shit out of me because I'm afraid of Bigfoot. I have been my entire life since I was a fucking kid. It terrifies me. Even when I was a kid, I had nightmares. Like, anytime it snowed outside, I'd have a nightmare about Bigfoot. I don't know why. He was always trying to fucking get me. I'd be in the bathroom.
Wait, isn't that a Yeti?
Yeah, well, yeah, I know. But the snow triggered something in me. I don't know what it was. I remember being after school, I'd come home. Okay, after school, especially elementary school, I had a 2 o'clock shit. 2 o'clock shit. I had to come home because no one goes poop at school. You don't do it, right? So you get out of school, and then you rush to the bathroom.
This is TMI, man.
No, it's just this
is TMI. Yeah. Tell him.
But no, I would still go to the bathroom. I'm sitting there. We had a window right to my right shoulder. I'll never forget it. And I'd look out there all the time between the little blinds. And I'd look at like the sticker bushes and stuff that were out there. And I swear to God, I always saw Bigfoot's face looking at me. And I was like, he was watching me all the time. I'll never forget it. Shit kills me. So anytime Bigfoot's brought up, I'm like, what did they say about Bigfoot? What? So when that came up in the doc, I was like, oh shit, what about Bigfoot? Mark, what are you talking about?
Well, so the thing is there are people out there especially in the kind of the ivory bill's extinct community who compare it to Bigfoot, who compare it to ETs. And it's unfortunately really false equivalents. Mm-hmm. And it's used to disparage the people who think that it's out there, who are convinced that it's out there. I don't even want to use the word believe.
Right.
Because it's really how they evaluate the evidence.
Yeah.
It's not a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
And the ivory bill is known to have existed in the United States until 1944 at the least recent. There's been abundant evidence since 1944 that the bird is still out there. Sightings by professional ornithologists, video, audio, photographs from various places. Mm-hmm. And people still compare it to Bigfoot, which has never been proven to have ever existed.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's used as a kind of trope to disparage people who think that the ivory bill is out there. And it's a false equivalence thing, and it gets used a lot.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a sore point for that reason.
Got you. Yeah. That would be.
Yeah.
I can understand that a lot.
Yeah, because you want to compare it to the dodo.
there's a species of bird called the cahow, Bermuda petrel, which was believed to be extinct for 300 years.
Wow.
And it finally was proved to exist when a dead bird washed up somewhere.
Okay.
And then it took another 50 or 60 years before they found where they were nesting.
Okay.
That's an extreme example, but this happens, and it happens a lot.
Oh, yeah. And
I need to ask an elementary scientific question.
Okay.
Please do, Chuck.
If a dead bird washes up, did you prove its existence because the one you found was dead? That's just an elementary scientific question.
Well, there might be people who would say, well, it was the last one. But,
exactly.
But basically, yeah.
Yeah.
If someone finds a dead bird or eDNA, which is something that that my team is starting to work on. You now can take DNA out of water and figure out what animals are present in the area. And they're even getting to the point where they can take it out in air samples. So hopeful that somewhere down the road we'll have some DNA evidence
as well.
Have
some more proof, yeah. Some bigger proof.
That's so interesting.
On a personal note, I'm no longer going to put body parts down the
drain.
Wow. DNA out of the water.
But the, no, there's so much of, and I
you just changed my Saturday night. Sorry, go ahead.
They say that there's so much unexplored about the water because there's places we cannot go. And so there's animals probably there, creatures there that we don't know about yet. And they talk about that quite a bit. But I think that that also includes flight animals too, because you don't necessarily always know. I mean, we don't know. They can go places we cannot go. So, you know, it is. Yeah. So I think that there's a lot more out there than we probably even know about as far as birds and sea life.
Andy, how long were you out there following Mark around trying to find this bird? I'm curious.
For this particular short, I spent, total, I think there were 11 shoot days.
Okay.
Spread over
3-4 months.
I think it was 3 different shoots. Yeah. And I think it was, I believe it was 11 total shoot days, if I recall correctly. So it was for a short, it was, I mean, that's a higher number of shoot days for a short. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. You know, I mean, it was, I grew up in the South my whole life, in a different region, but it was cool.
Yeah. You know, the terrain though, you got a good grasp of the, where you were kind of going and what was out there, or were you just like I would be going underwater when I was filming Sam's movie. I wouldn't go underwater, by the way.
Well, I mean, I had not been to that particular patch of National Forest before. Okay. That's, you know, I grew up in the Ozarks, and so this was a different terrain in Louisiana, and it basically, but for the most part, it's like similar vegetation, similar wildlife, to a degree. The Ozarks are a different elevation, but yeah, I mean, I learned my way, you know. I mean, I basically, you know, kind of shadowed Mark, except for the night that he left me in the woods. It's like I looked up, I was filming B-roll, and dude left me in the woods, and I had to push my way out with all my camera gear for like 3 hours. But outside of that, it was...
Fucking Mark, where are you?
Well, like you said,
this communication with texting, I think, was the problem there.
Hey, man, you don't leave your buddy in the woods, man.
Don't leave a fallen soldier.
Dude,
much less when they've never been there before.
Well, Mark apparently really had to crap, and everybody knows you can only crap at home, so he's like, bye.
But that's TMI, remember?
TMI. Yeah.
We don't tell.
No, that'd be a nightmare. I'd be scared out of my mind. I'd have lost my shit. I would have met up with Mark and be like, fuck it, I'm packing my shit. I'm gone. You're on your own, Mark. See ya. Bye.
Oh, Aaron, you're a different species in the woods.
Yeah.
Here's a GoPro. Keep filming. Bye.
Yep. I get nervous out there. The only reason I go in the woods is because we're making movies. I wouldn't go out there if it wasn't for that.
Well, you did.
I know. Once. But I didn't. It's not. It has to be filmmaking. It has to be. There's no other reason for me to go out there. I respect the animals and their home. They don't come here at our house. I ain't going out there.
They
I'm
do
good.
Too. Sometimes
yeah, and they off. And those are the disrespectful animals.
Wow. Well, now that Sam stopped putting dog food out for the raccoons, they don't come around as often.
Well, they still do because we got cats still. So
yeah, I didn't put food out for them. They just ate it. They're hungry, okay?
Hungry animals. All right, Mark, let's talk about something. This is great. Before the show, before we ran out of time.
He has to
so,
know.
Yeah, I gotta know. The Tantra stuff. This is great. This is great stuff. This is great. Chuck doesn't know anything about this.
We want you to make a documentary on
You're fucking
on
cute.
This.
No, you don't. You, no, Chuck, actually, Chuck is not a guy. You're not in the subtle things. You know, you don't like slow embraces and things like that. You're one of those pounders. You're one of those. Wow. I'm the kind of guy with Sam where I'm like, want to look you in the eye, you know, and I love that stuff. So, Mark, please. How did you get into that shit, dude?
I love just it. Left the screen.
I love it. It's fun.
Well, I think I, like a lot of people, I kind of read about it and all this stuff about great sex. And it interested me on that level. My first marriage ended. And I've looked at a couple of books about it during the first marriage. And I thought, oh, that's kind of weird.
Okay.
I can't relate to it. Few years after the marriage ended, I was just like, this girl had dumped me, and I was like, I'm going to go take a workshop in California and sort of see what this Tantra stuff is all about. And I had a really, really profound experience with it and kind of dove into it from there. And ultimately, it's really not about sex. Right. I mean, sex is one path to expanded consciousness, right? That's, and the core of what Tantra is about is consciousness expansion, using your embodied experience to expand your consciousness. And the sex part was, you know, a big focus, but by no means all of it. And we really went through, my wife and I, traditional training and initiation. Mm-hmm. I was a Swami for a time in an Indian lineage. I renounced that for reason that there was a history of sexual abuse in the lineage. And so I didn't want to associate with it anymore. Gotcha. As my teacher, who was in Australia, renounced at the same time. So that was part of why I left Tantra behind, was just a lot of messiness in it.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
I use the practices every day.
So the overall idea of it is a beautiful thing. You just don't... It's the
connecting and stuff. Yeah. And opening up and all that stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I get it.
And the core of it, like, for my wife and me, is treating the relationship as a spiritual practice. Right. That's okay. Sort of essential
component. So connecting on a different level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many different
levels. Yeah. Many different levels. Okay.
I remember that stuff. Yeah. Chuck and I were talking about that earlier on today. We were just like, remember that from the 90s? I mean, that was a big deal for a while.
As soon as that part, I admit, I was watching it this morning as I was doing breakfast, getting ready to start my day, and I was watching your guys' video. And as soon as your little video popped up of the from the 90s, and I was like, that's why this fucker looks familiar. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Apologize. I can't offend Mark by saying fuck. He said fuck more times in that museum.
I love it.
This is not, by the way, this
I was
is
a
not...
punk rocker in New York in the 1970s, too.
Oh. Here, I'm going to say this right now. This shows how much passion Mark has. Yeah. However, it also shows the fact that this will never be shown in a school. Because he said fuck more times than Aaron does in any script he ever writes.
That's true. It was good though. I love that about it. Yeah, and I was going to tell Andy
that
too.
I'm glad you bring that up. Though, did I?
No, you did say motherfucker.
My 2-year-old grandson, that's his favorite word.
I love that Andy used the raw language. Like, you know, that's one thing we talked about when we were interviewing people. If they ended up saying something, you know, that we want to clip that. We decided yes, but Andy, I love that you kept that in there. I love it.
Yeah, man, 100%. I mean, it shows the. I mean, like, you should see my other film, Wild Hogs and Saffron. I had Bubba. I think he said fuck 42 times.
Beautiful.
And that film will air on Independent Lens nationally. So PBS. When he saw the film, he was like, "Do I really cuss that much?" I had to make a spreadsheet of all your fucking PBS and then bleep them out because the director's cut shows at the festivals, but PBS, obviously, you know, they're going to cut all that stuff out. So,
yeah.
But yeah, at any rate, yeah, it's great. I think, I mean, I have two thoughts. So one, like, yeah, that scene where Mark is like raw like that, honestly, like that was like the realest version of Mark.
Yeah.
And we talked a lot about like not trying to get an A on the paper as a participant. Like I'm in the film with Bubba, and like I understand what it's like to try to like curate your likeness, but it's not good cinema and it's not real.
It's not real.
It's not real. Yeah.
People feel that. Like people totally feel it, and it loses, and it feels like a bad infomercial or something.
It's fucking cheap.
It's cheesy. Cheesy.
I get it. It's cheap.
No, it is. Yeah, it is fucking cheap. You know, that's the right word. Like, it's like, it's cheap. It's not what I do, and it's not documentary.
And it's
like
not real.
That. Yeah. No, it's not. People feel it. I mean, I've looked at footage of myself, and I'm like, dude, like, you're trying to put it on the paper. Like, this is not good. It just, like, you feel no emotion.
It looks that gross, don't it?
What's that?
It looks gross, right? When you see yourself like that, you're
it
like,
does. Oh, it's just sake. Not good, you know? And it's like, if you want to make an infomercial or like a real film that people connect with emotionally? And mm-hmm. I think that moment in the museum was very important, because I think that was like Mark at his realest. And like, you see, you can feel how much passion he has for the bird.
Yep.
And he's not using talking points, and he's not rehearsing. and it's just real. And that is, and you guys probably felt that, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Definitely. I loved it right away. Yeah, it's raw as fuck.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yep. We connected with it immediately because of the realness of it.
It made me like Mark right away, too. I was just like, definitely. Mark's a shit. I love Mark. What's up? Yeah. As soon as I saw that movie, it makes a difference.
Yeah, because you're a real person. And I think nowadays, you know, the whole cussing thing nowadays and cussing and stay away
words
from this,
in general.
Stay away from that. Words, yeah. And you can't say this and you can't say that and all that stuff. It just, and trying to make something and stay away from all of that or be so PC about everything is actually pretty hard anymore. I mean, people just don't talk like that anymore.
No. Yeah, it's sterile film and it lacks soul completely. And it's not like I don't want any part of that as a filmmaker. And it's, I really appreciated Mark's vulnerability in that moment. It embodied his passion. And the programmer, Big Sky, actually told me like that particular scene was like the most moving because you can kind of feel that. And that was like my favorite. Even like the cinematography is very limited in that because I was a one camera setup and it's like there's like you don't have a crazy amount of cutaways, but like energy of Mark's energy and like his passion expressed like makes up for that, you know. And that's and to your point about the tantra and the sex and whatnot, like that was something, you know, Mark watched every cut of this film. This is something that was important to make sure he was comfortable with everything. You know, we have the sign off from him on every cut, and then I feel like that chapter, I know he had a tough time with that chapter of his life, but it's such a, I mean, it's by far like it, like from the beginning, I told him that was that pivot, that life pivot to like tantra and sex to Ivory Bill Woodpecker. That's what made me do the film. If it was just Ivory Bill Woodpecker, I don't know that I would have signed up as director.
It gave a different element and a realness to Mark, especially where you're just like, okay, so this is like, these are two very real passionate things.
But yeah, but he makes a great point though, and I didn't even think of it until he just said it. You know, there's a bridge there that's just this strange bridge that you would never connect those two things before until you think about it. You know, being spiritual like Mark is, you can tell he is, and then how he's connected to nature and this bird, especially. I mean, it all comes together.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing for me is I don't do things halfway.
And that makes sense.
I mean, I think that comes across too.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a fucking beautiful thing. And that's a beautiful way to be. You know, that's what I think is vital. When you find people out there on the planet that do give it their all like that, you know, that's the people we look for to tell stories, because I know I try, and I know we all try at our production company here, but there's times when we're fucking pussies and we're like, Jesus Christ, I'm just tired. I don't want to do anything. You know, but then you see people out there on the planet like pursuing passions and dreams and their goals and something that means something fucking to them.
Yeah.
How do you not tell that story? How do you not want to get that out there?
And you're
it's inspiring.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I think that's like one of the things that drew me to Mark initially was that he goes all in on things, and that I feel like we really captured that from the Ivory Bill realm. I don't feel like we captured that from the Tantra world. And I think that is like that. I think, you know, just from an audience perspective, like even in the audience at Big Sky, like the most audible, you know, reactions were in the moments of rawness and vulnerability and like the pivots there, because it is like there probably is no other human on the planet that's done both
yeah,
deep and achieved such level of expertise in both. And so finding that common denominator of the spirituality and the quest for understanding, but that's where the depth of the humanity is, and that's where you're going to connect with Mark as a person. And by virtue of that, you connect with like the search for the bird and the importance of the bird is like you connect with Mark emotionally, and by virtue of that, then you connect with the bird.
Correct.
And
he
I think
makes
you
want to know about the bird.
Yeah, he does.
He does. Yeah. He definitely, his passion, Mark, your passion. I'm talking about you like you're not here. But Mark, your passion.
He's just sitting here being like, talk more about me.
No, but it draws you in as a watcher of the film. It really draws you in. Just the passion you have Yeah. And how you sit there and compare it to whatever else in your life that you felt. It just shows that your deep, deep compassion towards things and passion.
And his man, yeah, like, he adores it. You can tell. Yeah. And it means something
you're
to him.
Like, you're all in. And it's very cool. And it does draw you in as a watcher of the film, for sure.
It's great.
So I love that.
And I do the same thing, guys, just so you know. I mean, when I watch something that comes to us as we get ready, I watch it as a producer and as a fan of film, whether it be a documentary, a narrative, whatever it is that I'm looking at. I watch it, when I watch it for the first time, I watch it both ways. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that went to my head. Once he got to, like, the third fuck in the museum, I was like, well, this isn't going to the educational programming anymore. But at the same time, I was like, but then I started paying a lot of attention to everything that happened after that point because I saw how much passion that Mark had for what he was doing. So there's certain things that you can sacrifice when it comes to certain things. So yeah, mm-hmm. Great. You know, maybe we'll have a few extra bleeps in PBS, as long as it's not so many bleeps that you can't tell what you're saying. but at the same time, yeah. I mean, having that much passion behind what you're doing, Mark, I give you all the props in the world, man.
Yeah, brother. Yeah, it's dope.
I think it is important to have those moments in there. I mean, like, my mentors are the Renault brothers. They're Verite filmmakers from Little Rock, Arkansas. Brent was, you know, the first American journalist killed in Ukraine in March 2022.
Oh, yeah.
Their first film, you know, Dope Sick Love, or I believe, I don't know if that was their first film, but, you know, within the first 10 minutes, there's a guy who's addicted to dope, and he needs more money. He's a straight man. He has a girlfriend. He's a young man. They follow him up to an apartment, CD location in New York, and he starts giving a really old, pretty, you know, CD looking man a blowjob, and they film the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it's raw as fuck, but it gives you like. There is really no sentence, paragraph, or essay that can communicate like the depths that the addiction has on him quite like that scene. And it was not done in a gratuitous way. It was not done in a mocking, exploitative way. Right. It was communicated like the grip of addiction in a way. And like that is the moments that we, you know, hope for, you know, as filmmakers. Not hope for, maybe is not the right word for that, but that's what we hope to communicate. That's a better way to say it. We want to communicate the through visual language.
The rawness. And
yeah,
the realism.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. Yeah. We don't hope for, but goddamn, it's good for
when
the
it
movie.
Happens.
This will
yeah.
help tell the story. Yes, this yes. will get people to understand the seriousness of this.
Yeah,
I totally get it. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's an interesting thing we do.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
And you guys are very, and both of you are very, very interesting.
I love you guys, man.
Yeah,
you guys are
awesome.
Badass.
We're fans.
You got me watching a Woodpecker movie. I never would have watched
it. I haven't seen Woodpecker since Woody. Okay,
yeah,
that's
so
all
Woodpecker. That's all I ever knew. I was like, we got a documentary about a Woodpecker? And I started watching it. I'm like, dude, this is badass. And then the end of it, I'm like, oh, shit, I thought it was like a feature. I didn't even know. I thought.
It was, you know, like gone too fast.
I did. Right. I was like, oh, shit. I want to know more. So anyway, it was very good, you guys.
Yeah, it was.
You should be proud of yourselves. It's fucking good.
And yeah. I can't wait to watch Wild Hogs and Saffron.
Yeah, we gotta check that out too. So what's on before we end the show? Then what do you guys got going on right now? Mark, you want to start?
Well, just getting out in the field as much as I can, and you know, we'll see where this goes in the festival circuit, and you know.
Just have fun with
hopefully
it.
Be doing a lot of festivals coming up.
Yeah. Good for you, man. No, yeah. Good for you. You should be proud of it. It'll do well. Yeah. It'll do well.
Yes.
Andy, how about you, bud?
I am got a couple films on the festival circuit. I DP'd a film last year that's nominated for an Oscar this year. So that's on March 10th. Wow. It's The Barber of the Rock. I was a Verite cinematographer on that. And then I have a year-long fellowship right now with HBO documentary to develop my next project. I have two that I'm working on, and then I'm in those are in early development, and then I'm in early production on a feature called Iranian Hillbilly, which is an expansion of Wild Hogs and Saffron, and that is me, Bubba, and then it expands significantly by including my pops, who is the Iranian immigrant in my fam, and that one's kind of the most immediate, urgent. I'm in the fundraising hustle. You all probably know about that.
We know that.
So
yeah, we do know about that.
Always fun.
Do you have one started? You have one going on?
I've gotten a few grants for that one. And continuously writing others and upgrading work samples and planning a production shoot. Persian New Year is March 20th, so I have something planned for that, particularly with my pops. And then it's just kind of as resources allow, you know, it's an eating the elephant one bite at a time sort of thing. So,
right. Well, we're forever friends now. So if you ever have anything you want us to plug for you or help you get out there in the world, let us know, send it to us and we'll definitely get it out there.
Yeah. We got a good tribe of people. They listen consistently. They're out there. So we'd love to help you guys if we can.
We would love to. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you guys so much. I'm excited to look into y'all's work as well, and it's nice to, you know, connect with y'all. I really enjoyed it. So
yeah, we had a great time too.
It was super fun.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Thank you for sharing your film
with
us.
Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. And everyone, where would people be able to see this besides the film festival, or is there a besides the film festival yet?
Not yet.
So you're waiting. Yeah. So it's in the film festival circuit as of yet.
Yeah, so that's where Jolene and I have been kind of exploring options for distributors. Online distributorship is a different, you know, it's a different animal. We have a couple of prospects for it that we've put some feelers out to, and then it's just kind of waiting to find the right one. And so for now, it is just watching virtually on film festivals or catching it in a theater at a film festival. And then hopefully we'll be able to cement an online distributor with several months. So,
Let us know when that happens. I don't care if it's a year from now. Just let us know and we'll get it out there.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys. Chuck, you want to close out the show, brother?
Oh, absolutely. Andy. Mark, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on Around the Reel. Thank you for hanging out for a cup of coffee and a conversation or an alcoholic beverage or absolutely nothing, depending on what you prefer. No matter what you prefer, please remember to always go out there and explore. Go out there and figure out what it is you love. And when you love something, chase it. Chase it like Mark. Chase running away from Tantra and running into something new like an ivory-billed woodpecker. Now, granted, like I said earlier, I haven't seen a woodpecker since I watched Woody back in the 1980s. So, Mark and Andy, thank you for giving me an opportunity to look into something that's a little bit more grown up than what I was used to. So, and thank you for sharing both of your passions. You could see it in both Mark's dialogue. You can see it in Andy's shooting. Thank you guys for joining us today. Thank you for sharing everything that you are with us. And remember, everybody out there, think hard, because you're thinking anyway.
We'll see everybody later.
Bye. For those of you that want to be a guest on Around the Reel, please email Sam at aroundthereel253@gmail.com.
That's aroundthereel253@gmail.com.
Not Messenger. Do not message Aaron on Messenger, because then he has to send you a message that says email Sam at aroundthereel253@gmail.com.
That's aroundthereel253@gmail.com.
How come they can't just message me again?
Because nobody wants to fucking talk to you.
Can anybody reach out that's an artist, filmmaker, actor?
If you're an artist of any kind, we want to hear from you.
But we are going to vet the crap out of you.
We don't care if you make millions of dollars in Hollywood or if you're just beginning your career in the art industry. We don't care. So everybody that wants to be on Around the Reel, yes, we want you.
That's aroundthereel253@gmail.com.